All right, everybody, good morning. This is Bible 231, and it's November 11th. And we're sort of in the middle of the census chapter, almost done with census chapter. So let me see if I can figure the schedule out here. Looks like we have a test scheduled for 1 week from today. Okay, 1 week from today. And then after that, there's only one test left. So that's really good. We get this test out of the way. And on that test is going to be from central nervous system through the heart. Right? So maybe we'll get to the heart today. And then you'll be set for the next test coming up. And don't forget, there's practicums that started last week, continuing this week. And I think even I have a class on Monday and next week, because Monday this week was a holiday. They have a practicum. All right, so anybody have any questions? Okay, we were talking about the eye last time. And I think we went over this figure right here. All right, so make sure you know the layers of the eye. What's the outermost layer called? Sclera. What color is it?
White.
That's right. It's the tough layer, sort of like the dura mater of the eye. Right, gives the eyeball its shape, protects the eye. The next deepest layer is the choroid, and it's filled with blood vessels. That's the layer that nourishes, maintains the sclera, but even more importantly, it nourishes and maintains the retina. And so the retina is the deepest layer. And what does the retina have?
Cones.
It has, cones and rod cells, which are the photoreceptor cells, and those are the things that generate electrical information that goes to your brain so that you have the perception of light and dark and color and objects and shapes and things like that. All right, so make sure you know these different layers. Let's see. All right, so that just kind of recapitulates everything about this particular figure right here. All right, I'm going to enable on Blackboard some labeling exercises of the eye for you in your weekly enhancements, so you can drag and drop some of these things. So maybe we'll try labeling some of these things like retina. Where does retina belong? Okay. Retina is a what? A layer of the eye, and it's the deepest layer, so I would say probably right here. All right. I guess that looks pretty good. Probably we do have some sound with this. And the iris. What's the job of the iris? It dilates or constricts depending on the amount of light that's available. All right. Who's? Hey, really good. All right. The lens does what? Who can tell me what the lens does? Okay. I guess we didn't talk about the lens yet. So that's what I was checking. That is the lens. Okay. And you see the lens is connected to a ciliary muscle, which is right here. And what's a muscle specialized to do? Contract. Right? So here's that ciliary muscle that contracts. It pulls on these suspensory ligaments that are attached to the lens. So suspensory ligaments go right here. All right, so when the ciliary muscle or ciliary body pulls on the lens changes shape. The process of changing the shape of the lens allows you to see things up close or far away. Can you see things up close and far away at the exact same time? No. Did we do that little experiment in class? Did you put your finger way out in front of you like this and focus on your fingernail? And how does everybody look behind your finger? Blurry. Now look at people that are behind your fingertip, and how does your fingertip look? You see like two or three maybe of them, and it's what mean very, very blurry. All right, so that process of changing the distance of focus from close up to far away is what we call accommodation. All right, so make sure you write that down. Accommodation is the result of this ciliary muscle pulling on the lens via these suspensory ligaments, changing the shape of the lens so that you can see things close up or far away, but not both at the same time. Okay, accommodation is the ability to focus up close or far away, but not both at the same time. And so it's the job of the lens, because the lens has to change shape for you to see things up close And then in order for you to see things far away, the lens has to change shape once again. And the muscle that pulls on the lens to change its shape is the ciliary muscle. All right, so how does the ciliary muscle attach to the lens? What's the structure that attaches it to the lens? The suspensory ligaments, right? Okay. So that's the job of the lens right here, is accommodation. It's just not focusing. There's another object that is very curved that actually has more focusing power than the lens does, and that is this object right here. What's this object right here that I'm outlining? How come I don't have an arrow? Wow, I don't have it labeled on here. Okay, that's the cornea. Okay, so make sure you know what the cornea is. Look, the cornea has curvature, so it focuses light as well. And it does even a better job than the lens, but the cornea can't change shape, so the cornea doesn't participate in accommodation. All right, but the shape of the cornea is very important for focusing light on the retina, so you get a nice, clear, sharp image right there. All right, so the two things that work together so that you can see things in focus are the cornea and the lens together, both working together. All right, the retina has two different kinds of cells. There are cells that are conically shaped, and then there are cells that are more columnar shaped, or photoreceptor cells. They're called rods and cones. And the cone cells are located right on the posterior pole of the eye, right here. When light comes in, it goes straight back and hits the retina. And this is the area that has primarily cone cells. And cone cells are small, so that means that you can see fine detail with cone cells. Cone cells also give you the ability to see color. So whenever you want to get a very good appreciation of an object, this is where your extrinsic eye muscles, right, position the eyeball so light falls right at the fovea centralis, which is in the center of the macula lutea. And I do remember talking about the macula lutea just a little bit last time. All right, but there's a trade-off. Since those cone cells are small, they need a lot of light in order to work. So they don't work in dim vision. So you don't see very good detail, you don't see color when the light is dim. There are other kinds of cells that give you that perception, and they're called rod cells, and they're in the periphery of your eyeball. So rod cells don't let you see fine detail, and they're only good for black and white or gray. But the advantage is that in dim light, they allow you to see something. Right, so you're not completely blind when the light gets dim because of what kind of cells? The rod cells are doing their job. Okay. So there's a line of demarcation that separates posterior part of the eye from the anterior part of the eye. And this posterior part right here is filled with vitreous humor, that jelly-like material that probably you all saw in lab. And this part of the eyeball is called the posterior segment. Posterior segment contains vitreous humor, right? And that's separated from the anterior segment of the eye right here by the lens and the suspensory ligaments and the ciliary muscle. So anything anterior to the lens is what we call the anterior segment. And it has a different kind of fluid in there. It has, yeah, aqueous humor. And aqueous means what? Watery. So it's just a watery-like material, and if I put a drop of water on the tabletop and then I lift up the table, what's going to happen to that drop of water? It's just going to roll right down the table, right? Okay. So that's one kind of disadvantage of having aqueous humor in this anterior segment, because if the cornea is ever perforated, guess what happens to that aqueous humor? It just runs right out of the eye. Okay, just like a tear running down your face. But that's not really the bad thing, right? Here's the bad thing. We said, in order for the lens to do its job, what does it have to do? Change shape. It's got to move around in order for you to see things up close or far away. So it's moving around inside your eyeball all the time. What about the iris that is adjusting for the amount of light that you're looking at, or the environment, the amount of light that's in the environment. What is it doing all the time? It's dilating, right, and constricting, dilating, constricting all the time. So it's moving around, right? And there's aqueous humor in all of these areas that separate the lens from the iris, separating the iris from the cornea. But when that aqueous humor runs out, when the cornea is perforated, all of these structures touch each other, right? The cornea can touch the iris. The cornea can touch the lens, and the iris touches the lens, right? And no one has ever figured out a way how to unstick those structures. So what does that mean for somebody's vision? If the iris is stuck to the lens, can it move around anymore? It's glued together. So what happens to somebody's vision? Totally screwed up, okay? And the same thing, if the cornea touches the iris right here, remember, the iris is supposed to move around, but if it can't move around, you're going to have some severe vision deficits. All right, so I always recommend, and this is really important in lab, that you wear eye protection all the time, right, to maintain, make sure that aqueous humor doesn't run out of this anterior segment. So there are two compartments of that anterior segment that you have to know. There is this anterior cavity and the posterior cavity that is separated by the iris, and they communicate with each other via the pupil. Now, the real reason why the pupil is there is not to allow aqueous humor to flow through it, but for what purpose? Why do we have a pupil in our eye? To let light into the retina, right? So the pupil really isn't a structure, it's just a hole in the... What is the pupil a hole in? In the... Okay, here's the lens, here's the iris. The pupil is a hole in the iris, right? So that's the best way to think of that pupil right there. All right, these ciliary processes produce that aqueous humor that flows over the lens into this anterior cavity of the anterior segment, and then it's drained from the eye via this scleral venous sinus right here. And if too much fluid is being produced, or if the scleral venous sinus is occluded, then pressure is going to build up in this anterior segment of the eye. Does anybody know what that's called?
Glaucoma.
That's called glaucoma. And that can destroy your retina and cause blindness if left untreated. Right? And you can't tell. You have no sense that that's happening to you whatsoever. Right? But every time you go get your eyes measured for glasses, they always check for glaucoma because it's such a serious disease. So pressure builds up in this anterior segment. It pushes on the vitreous humor in the posterior segment. The vitreous humor then pushes on the retina, which then pushes on the blood vessels of the choroid, and it stops the delivery of oxygen and nutrients to the retina, and the retina then gradually dies. And when it's dead, what do you see? Nothing. All right, so glaucoma is a pretty dangerous condition that should be treated. Okay. Here is the optic nerve that is receiving signals from all the rod cells and cone cells, and it attaches to the retina right at this location right here. That's called the optic disc. And since there is nervous tissue in this region of the eye, you have no photoreceptors. Right? There is no functional retina right here at this location, so another name for the optic disc is called the blind spot. So all of us have two blind spots, one in one eye, one in the right eye, one in the left eye. But can you find it right now? If you're looking around the room, can you see your blind spots? No, you can't see them. Because your brain is so important in terms of and so powerful in processing information, it fills that blind spot in with information that it's getting from the other eye. But if you want to see your blind spot sometime, maybe after class, during office hours, or in lab, I'll put a little diagram on the board. And if you move your head just in the right way, that little diagram that I put on the board will just completely disappear. You'll just see like a whiteboard. And that will demonstrate that you have a blind spot. Okay, so that's pretty much it for the eye. Visual pathways, unless there's some questions at the back of the book, I'm not so concerned about visual pathways. Sometimes we talk about different tunics of the eye. What the heck is a tunic? It's a coat or a covering. Right, so instead of thinking of the eye being made of the sclera, the choroid, and the retina, we could think of some other tunics that make up the eye. The fibrous tunic is made up of the sclera. All right, and that's easy to appreciate because that's just the outermost layer of the eye. That includes the cornea, which is transparent to light. The vascular tunic is made up of the choroid, all right, and the ciliary body and the iris. Right, they're all continuous with the choroid. And then the sensory tunic is made up of the neural layer, which has those rod and cone cells, as well as a pigmented layer with melanocytes in it. Right, that help absorb light, so when light enters your eye, it doesn't flash around inside your eyeball, because then you would actually see flashes of light, like a almost like a hallucination or something. All right, so that's the visual system. So let's move on to the ear. And the ear has three main senses associated with it. So let's take a look at an ear first and then talk about some of these senses. All right, so here's a pretty good illustration of the ear. And this is probably a review already from what you covered in anatomy. But the ear has got three main locations. There is an external ear, a middle ear, and an inner ear. And these different compartments perform different functions that we're going to become familiar with. All right, and you're familiar with this hole right here in, what bone is this? What bone is associated with your auricle or pinna? Yeah, that's the temporal bone. And what's this big hole in the temporal bone? Yeah, that's the external auditory meatus or acoustic meatus. All right, and that's a part of the temporal bone. All right, so this is what allows sound waves, which is a pressure wave, it's a mechanical wave, to enter your head to stimulate the sensory receptors for hearing. All right, so the external ear starts over here at the pinna. It includes the external acoustic meatus, right, and then it ends right here at the tympanic membrane. So here is a thin membrane that vibrates back and forth, right, when there is sound in the space that you're occupying. So how do you know that sound is a pressure wave that vibrates things back and forth? What in your everyday experience have you recognized that sound produces vibrations? Okay, and sound really is synonymous with a vibration. It's just pressure that's varying above and below atmospheric pressure. I know y'all can think of some, because you probably all did it this morning on the way to school. Radio. The radio in your car, right? And you turned it up, and, okay, you're driving down the freeway, and what was the sound of the radio? Not loud enough. So you turned it up, okay? And you go, oh, I really like that song. And what did you do to the volume? Turn it up some more, okay? And then you got off the freeway to a stoplight, right? And everything's nice and quiet. And then you look in your rearview mirror, and what is your rearview mirror doing? What was it doing this morning? Oh, you can't fool me. I know, it's vibrating back and forth wildly. Okay, that's the sound vibrations, right? So when you were looking at your rearview mirror vibrating back and forth wildly, guess what your tympanic membrane was doing? Exactly the same thing, produced by those pressure waves, right? Okay, so that's the job of the tympanic membrane, to capture sound vibrations. And then the tympanic membrane is the line that separates the external ear from the middle ear. So here's the middle ear compartment. The middle ear has got some tiny bones in them. These are what we call the auditory ossicles. They carry the vibrations from the tympanic membrane into this part of the ear, which is the inner ear. Right? So this is the vestibular apparatus right here. And this is the organ that's responsible for a number of senses, including hearing. So these three bones are the malleus, incus, and stapes. And look at the stapes right here. It kind of looks like a stirrup that you'd use to ride a horse with. And the base of the stapes is nice and oval. There is a corresponding membrane to the tympanic membrane that acts as a threshold for sound energy to enter the vestibule right here. All right, so this has a particular shape, and it has a shape of an oval, so we call that the oval window. So sound enters the vestibular apparatus via the oval window, which is being vibrated by the stapes, which in turn is vibrated by these other bones in the middle ear, okay, because the tympanic membrane is vibrating back and forth. All right, so those are the three parts of the ear, three main parts, external, middle, and inner. All right, and this tympanic membrane has to vibrate back and forth. What do you think would happen if the tympanic membrane, if we push it all the way to the right, if we push it all the way to the right and hold it as far as it can go to the right, guess what's going to happen to it? Will it be able to vibrate? No, it won't be able to vibrate. And if it can't vibrate, guess what? You won't be able to hear anything. All right, so what's important about this middle ear right here is that there must be a way to equalize the pressure on from the external side to the middle side of the tympanic membrane. And here is a little tube that goes to your pharynx. Another name for your pharynx is your throat. Okay, so here's a tube that goes from your throat to the middle ear, so that if you go up in the mountains, or you go up in an airplane, or go down from a mountains down into Los Angeles or something, and there's air pressure changes, you might notice a hearing loss. All right, and the way to adjust and get your hearing back is to force some air up through this pharyngotympanic tube. Sometimes we call that the Eustachian tube. Sometimes it's called the auditory tube. And that re-equalizes the pressure so that this tympanic membrane goes right back to the middle, and then it can vibrate back and forth again. All right, there's another condition that disturbs your hearing besides pressure changes, and that is maybe you have an infection of the middle ear that's called otitis media, and this compartment fills up with fluid or maybe pus or something like that, and guess what happens to your hearing? It diminishes because the tympanic membrane can't vibrate back and forth anymore. Right, and typically little kids get that otitis media pretty easily whenever they have a sore throat or a cold or something. But you can now appreciate how easy it is to get otitis media when you have a sore throat because, why? It's attached via the pharyngotympanic tube, right? Okay. All right, so those are the parts of the ear. And what we're going to look at in particular right now, you can see, I want to talk about the three parts of the inner ear. All right, so this thing right here that kind of looks like a snail all rolled up, that's what we call the cochlea. And it's made out of a bony material. And there are a lot of cavities and spaces inside the cochlea, so we call that the bony labyrinth. And the sense that the cochlea gives you is the sense of hearing. The other part of the inner ear, right, is right here. And again, it's made out of bony material, so we call that the other bony labyrinth. But it's the vestibule. The vestibule gives you the sense of head position. If your head is erect, right, or if you're facing down, or if your head is moved behind you, gravity is working on some structures inside the vestibule that gives you the sense of head position. Right, so the vestibule gives you the sense of what we call linear acceleration. So even if you're in your car or an elevator and you start to accelerate or decelerate, this is the part of the ear that maintains your equilibrium so that you don't lose your balance and fall over, right? But it's linear acceleration. So that means it can tell if you're moving right and left, up and down, or frontwards and backwards in just a linear sense. The last part of the vestibular apparatus are these canals that you see looping around in the inner ear. These are what we call the semicircular canals. And again, they're made out of a bony material, so we call this the bony labyrinth. And in the semicircular canals, there is fluid that can actually flow around and around in a circle. These things are important for equilibrium, like the vestibule is, but a different kind of equilibrium. Not linear acceleration, but spinning. So when you start to spin right to left or head over heels, okay, then fluid moves through these semicircular canals and it gives you the sense of angular acceleration. So linear acceleration from the vestibule, angular acceleration or spinning from the semicircular canals. So those are the three senses in the inner ear. You have hearing, and then you have two senses for equilibrium. Linear acceleration, sometimes we call static equilibrium, and angular acceleration, sometimes we call kinetic equilibrium. And you need all of those to maintain your balance when you're moving. So when you were a little kid and started to spin and then stop and then you open your eyes and you see the world spinning around you even though you stop moving, that's because of the information that is being given to your brain from these semicircular canals that give you the sense of angular acceleration or spinning. All right, so let's see if we can take a look at some detail inside these different structures. Okay, so we're looking at the vestibule right here, and here are a couple organs. We call these organs the maculae, right? One is a macula, and here is a utricle and a saccule. They're both maculae, right? These are the organs that give you the sense of linear acceleration or static equilibrium. So let's zoom into this region, and when we zoom in at a microscopic level, this is what we see. All right, we see an epithelium of support cells, and then we see some receptor cells that have these cilia poking off the apical surface of them, and we call these stereocilii. And they can bend, and when they bend, they send electrical signals to the brain. All right, so when the heck do these things bend? Well, these stereocilia project up into a mass of material right here, which is what we call the otolith membrane, but it's a gelatinous mass. Right, it's like jelly. And then on top of the jelly-like material are these otoliths. And otoliths are little crystals of calcium carbonate. So they're like little rocks that you have inside your inner ear associated with the utricle and saccule right here. And what can you tell me about rocks? If you're going to pick up a rock, what are they like? They're heavy, right? So gravity pulls on the otoliths. All right, and so when your head is stationary, these otoliths press straight down and don't bend the hair cells. But when you tilt your head, right, then these otoliths pull down on the otolith membrane and it bends these cilia, and that sends electrical information to your brain saying that your head has changed position. Okay, so don't forget about these little rocks inside the vestibule. They make up the utricle and saccule, which then give you the sense of head position. All right, so here I can see the otolithic membrane, the otoliths, right, and they're connected to these receptor cells that we call hair cells, not because they grow hair inside your ear like you have on the top of your head, but because they grow these really long cilia, right, that can bend when you change your head position. Right, and since gravity is pulling straight down, that is a linear acceleration on the vestibule of the ear. All right, so remember the name of these cells. What are the name of those receptor cells that give you the sense of static equilibrium or linear acceleration? What's the name of those cells in there? The otoliths are these little rocks, these little crystals, but the cells themselves are. Here are the receptor cells. Okay? Yeah, just go ahead and say it out loud because it's just weird. They're hair cells. Okay? Because growing off the surface of these hair cells are these stereocilia that reminded somebody of hair. Right? Okay, so hair cells for the sense of static equilibrium. All right, another sense. Let's look at the... Right, these semicircular canals. down at the base of every semicircular canal, there are three semicircular canals, there is a little bulge. That little bulge we call an ampule. This is the ampule of a semicircular canal. And what the heck is an ampule? Ampule is a little vial that's containing fluid. Sometimes you're going to get a shot, maybe of a vaccine, and it's in a little glass vial. They have to break it open to get the material out. That's called an ampule, right? So an ampule contains drugs, or it's just a little containment device for something. So they call these the ampulla of the semicircular canals, and there are receptor organs inside the ampule for that, what we call angular acceleration or twisting motion. All right, so what do these things look like? All right, this is it. So here is the ampule, and here's the semicircular canal that's filled with fluid, endolymph. And then here is an epithelium that's lining the ampule. And then there is another gelatinous mass in this area right here that we call the cupula. Right, and that's poking up into the endolymph, and then sticking up into the cupula, that gelatinous mass, are some stereocilia from a cell. What kind of cell produces stereocilia? Where did we run into that? We ran into that in the utricle and saccule. What did we call those cells? These are hair cells, right? The same kind of cells, right? Almost used the exact same way. And then the hair cells can send electrical information to these nerve fibers. This is the vestibular nerve that goes to the brain. And then you have this sense of angular acceleration or spinning as a result. All right, well, how and why does that work? All right, well, because of a property that we call momentum. What the heck does momentum do for us? What does momentum mean? It's a property of mass. So this almost sounds like a little bit of physics. All right. Oh, this is a really good time of year to demonstrate this particular property. Okay. What can you tell me about momentum and mass? Momentum says that if an object is stationary, if it's not moving, guess what it likes to do? It likes to just remain stationary. It doesn't like to get moving. All right, so stationary objects like to remain stationary. In order to get them to move, you have to apply a lot of force to them to get them to go. But there is a corollary to momentum as well. And that is, once you get an object moving, guess what it likes to do? It likes to stay moving, right? Keep going in a certain direction. It doesn't like to stop. In order to stop something, again, you have to apply force to get them to stop or to get it to stop. So that's momentum. All right, so here I have a little water bottle, and inside my water bottle I have, what's in there? Look at your slide. What's in your semicircular canals? You have, and what's that fluid called? Endolymph. You have endolymph in there, all right? So that endolymph has momentum, all the properties of matter. All right, so here, let's put this ear down here, the semicircular canal with endolymph in it. And you can demonstrate this in a couple weeks, right? During Thanksgiving, maybe you have a bunch of people come over to your house, right? And have a kind of get-together party with a lot of wine glasses and candles on the table, right? And all kinds of dishes with things on the table. And you're going to demonstrate to your family the concept of momentum by taking the tablecloth and doing what? And yanking it out from all the candlesticks and wine glasses and wine bottles and stuff, and nothing's going to spill, right? So could you demonstrate that very easily just by doing what? Just like that. It's really easy to do, all right? So I recommend everybody do that experiment at home, okay? So that's momentum. Fluid in your ear likes to stay stationary when you start to move. So the fluid in your inner ears is this bottle right here. When you start to move, guess what it does? It stays still. Okay. Now, if you start spinning around for a long period of time, that fluid does what? It catches up, right? So it's going to catch up. You know, you can move it. It's going to catch up. It's going to start spinning at the rate that your head is spinning at. But what's going to happen to that fluid if all of a sudden you stop? What's going to happen? It's going to keep going, and we could demonstrate that with the endolymph in this bottle again. Let's get it going, and then I'll stop really suddenly. What is that bottle going to want to do? it's going to want to keep going, right? Good thing I have the cap on there. So if I move it and then stop, I need more. Here, we'll start slowly and then stop suddenly, okay? I had to catch it. That is what? That's momentum. So that endolymph in your ear has momentum. So guess what it's going to do? Here are the ampulla. There's fluid in each of these semicircular canals. So here's somebody that's stationary. What's the endolymph doing when somebody is standing still? It's standing still. What happens if all of a sudden you start spinning? This cupula moves with your head, but the fluid is stationary, so it's going to push on the cupula to the left. And when it pushes on the cupula, guess what it does to these stereocilia? It bends them, and that sends electrical signals to the brain saying that you're starting to spin in a particular direction. I don't know if I have the next slide here. Not really. Okay. Well, what happens if this person then starts to spin for like a minute? What happens to the endolymph? It catches up, all right, and then you stop suddenly, and what happens? It pushes on the cupula the opposite way because that fluid has momentum, and then that sends other signals to the brain saying that, oh, you must be spinning in the opposite direction, right? That is just an inappropriate sensation because of the way you trick the system to work. And when you open up your eyes, what does the world look like? It kind of looks like it's spinning because that endolymph is still spinning in your semicircular canals. But how long does it last? Not really long, because that endolymph eventually stops moving in your semicircular canals and stops pushing on the cupula right here, and you're back to normal equilibrium. All right, so this thing right here that gives you the sense of angular acceleration or spinning is what we call the crista ampullaris. Right, so this organ for kinetic equilibrium is the crista ampullaris. What was the organ for static equilibrium called? What is that organ? Oh, here's the crista ampullaris right here, a nice big view of it. For static equilibrium, it is the maculae. Okay? Here is the maculae, and you got a utricle and a saccule. This is for static equilibrium. All right, now what's something that the macula and the crista ampullaris have in common? What are the receptor cells? Does that seem strange to you? I think that's strange, right? Why you have something called a hair cell, but they're called hair cells because of those stereocilia. But the sense of acceleration, linear compared to angular acceleration, is totally different, but your body uses the same type of receptor cell for that perception. All right, the last sense. What is the last sense that we want to talk about? And that is, what are the three senses in the ear? I'll write this on the board in just a little bit. We've got linear acceleration or static equilibrium. We've got angular acceleration or kinetic equilibrium. What else do you use your ears for? Good, somebody's listening. Okay, hearing, that's right, hearing. All right, so those are the three parts of the inner ear. Here are the semicircular canals for angular acceleration, the vestibule for linear acceleration, and then the cochlea for hearing. All right, so what happened to this cochlea right here? What does it normally look like? It normally looks like a snail. That means it's all rolled up. And the cochlea is all rolled up because you would want your cochlea to fit inside your head. If it was all unrolled, your cochlea would be sticking outside your head. All right, so folding is just a way to make something smaller to fit in a big object to fit in a small space. So unroll the cochlea, and this is what the cochlea looks like on the inside. Sound enters the cochlea via, right, the stapes when it's vibrating back and forth, because it presses on the oval window. The oval window, right, it then pressurizes fluid in here, this first little canal we call the scala vestibuli. All right, and so now sound pressure enters the scala vestibuli, and it's going to go around in the cochlea, and then that pressure is going to be released by another membrane covering the round window. So the round window can vibrate back and forth, and that's really important because sound vibrations are energy. And if all that energy were to enter the cochlea and it had no place to go, guess what would happen to the cochlea? It would fracture, it would break. So the round window is necessary to relieve that pressure. The fluid in the scala vestibuli right here is what we call perilymph. It's surrounding this inner chamber right here. Right, the chamber on the bottom is called the scala tympani. So vestibuli on the top, tympani on the back. Tympani is connected to the round window. The scala vestibuli is connected to the oval window. So sound enters the scala vestibuli via the perilymph, right? And then it's going to move across this cochlear duct right here. So the cochlear duct is going to vibrate in one location or another depending on the dimension of this cochlear duct. So that's just due to a relationship of physical size to a natural mode of vibration for various objects. So how does the frequency of vibration associate itself with the size of an object? What kind of objects can vibrate very, very fast? And what kind of objects can vibrate back and forth very slowly? Okay, by shape. How would you describe the shape? Think of maybe you could think of a guitar, not a really good example, but you could think of that. How about a piano? What's inside of a piano that makes noise? Strings, okay? And those strings correspond to different frequencies of vibration. So how would you describe the whole different set of strings that you could have in a piano? Yeah, you've got some that are really short, some that are kind of mid-length, and then you got some that are really long. So the really long ones play or vibrate with low frequencies. And the very, very short ones vibrate back and forth at high frequencies. And the ones in the middle are what we call mid-range frequencies. So your ear works pretty much the same way. Right, so the cochlea, the dimension, right, as we're looking into the plane, this part of the cochlea is very big and wide. Right, so this part of the cochlea will vibrate at low frequencies. This part of the cochlea is very, very thin. So it will vibrate at only high frequencies. So when sound comes into your ear, different frequencies of that sound will vibrate different parts of the cochlear duct right here. So in essence, what do you have inside both ears? You have like two musical instruments. What do you have inside your ears? You have, what is that? What is that fantastic drawing of? Piano. How do you spell piano? Okay. You have like two pianos inside the cochlea that vibrate in different regions depending on the frequency of sound that's entering them. Okay. And then that information is passed on via the cochlear nerve to the primary auditory cortex for you to appreciate that particular sound. All right, so I want you to know scala vestibuli, scala tympani, and the cochlear duct, all right between them. The tip of the cochlea right here, this is what we call the helicotrema. This is for extremely low frequencies, the perception of very, very low frequencies. All right, so how does that work? Well, let's go back and take a really nice look at the inside of the cochlea. All right, so here's a cross-section of the cochlea. And let's just look at this one area right here. So here is the scala vestibuli. What's connected up to the scala vestibuli? Go back to another picture somewhere in your book. Scala vestibuli has the perilymph. It's connected to the oval window. This is how sound enters the cochlea. The scala tympani is connected to the round window right here. All right, so don't forget, sound is going to move from the scalovestibuli into the tympani across the cochlear duct. And what it does, all right, it's going to vibrate this structure right here. So let's zoom into this structure. This is what we call the organ of Corti. So here is the organ of Corti. The organ of Corti has got this tectorial membrane that sits right on top of a number of the, you're very familiar with this now. What are these cells right here? These are the receptor cells for sound vibrations. These are hair cells because they have stereo cilia on them. And when sound vibrates this tectorial membrane, guess what happens to these stereo cilia? They vibrate too, and when they move, that sends up electrical signals to the brain. And it goes to the brain, to the primary auditory cortex, to different regions of the brain, and your brain is laid out just like a piano. If you stimulate one area, it will be a high frequency. If you stimulate an area next to it, it will be a mid-range frequency. And if you stimulate another part of the brain, right, it will be a low frequency. So you can hear all these different frequencies. All right, and that's because that sound wave is going to move right across this cochlear duct. All right, so this is what we call the organ of Corti, right here. And I don't think I have a picture of the way sound is appreciated in the brain, but this is the primary auditory cortex. But I can describe that quickly to you. All right, so here is the primary auditory cortex. So this region of the brain is going to be responsible for high frequencies. When we stimulate this part of the brain, you're going to perceive mid-range frequencies. And when this part of the brain is stimulated, you're going to appreciate low frequencies. All right? So you have on the cortex of the temporal lobe, again, things that resemble pianos. You have like two pianos in your brain that allow you to hear different notes or different frequencies of sound. And so from all of that, right, you can understand language, appreciate music, and all of that stuff. All right, so let's draw a little table on the board that compares these three senses of the inner ear. All right, so you might want to jot this down. What are those three senses again? You've got hearing. That's one. Yeah, linear. Linear acceleration. All right, now let's see. What's another way for saying linear acceleration? We could say static equilibrium. All right, I'll just abbreviate that. Static equilibrium. So we're two-thirds of the way there. What's another one? Angular acceleration. That's really nice. Three. Angular. What's another way of saying angular acceleration? Spinning. Okay. Angular acceleration. And this is what we call kinetic equilibrium. All right, I'll abbreviate that. Kinetic equilibrium. All right, so then we got what? We got the different parts of the ear. Outer ear, middle ear, inner ear. Which ones for the outer ear? The outer ear is important for which ones of these senses? All of them? The outer ear is important. Is that important for hearing? Okay, put your fingers in your ears and let me tell you what's on the test. Would you like to do that? No, because you need what? You need your outer ear to hear, right? So outer ear for hearing, absolutely. We'll put a check mark right here. What about linear acceleration? You need your outer ear to appreciate linear acceleration. You don't. All right, so we'll X that. And angular acceleration, that's the semicircular canals. Where are they? They're in the inner ear, so that's not important. So you need your outer ear only for hearing. What about the middle ear? Do you need that for hearing? If you have otitis media, it's all plugged up with fluid and stuff, can you hear? Not very well. Check mark. What about linear and angular acceleration? Don't need the middle ear for any of those. All right. Now, what about for the inner ear? Is that important for hearing? In particular, what's the bony labyrinth? Bony labyrinth. What's the bony labyrinth necessary for hearing? The thing that's all curled up. What's that? Cochlea. All right, so the cochlea is important for hearing. All right, and is the cochlea part of the inner ear? Yes, absolutely. All right, now what about linear acceleration? Is the inner ear important for linear acceleration? Yeah, that's the last part. It's got to be there. What part? So check that. What part of the inner ear gives you the sense of linear acceleration? Vestibule. All right, and what about angular acceleration? Absolutely, that's important. What's the bony labyrinth for angular acceleration? The semicircular canals. Are important. All right. And let's see, what else? How else could we compare these things? How about the organs? The receptor organs. What are the receptor organs for hearing? Something inside the bony labyrinth. What do you need inside that bony labyrinth to hear something? Okay. Starts with the name organ. Organ of Corti. Right? And what about for linear acceleration? Macula. Singular. And then for angular acceleration, what is the thing that's sensitive for spinning when the endolymph pushes on it one way or the other? That's called the crista ampullaris. Crista ampullaris. Right? That's that thing that's in the little ampule, the little bulge at the base of a semicircular canal. And remember, the maculae have those otoliths in there. All right. Now, what about the cell, the receptor cell? That actually generates electrical information that ends up in your brain. What's the receptor cell for hearing? Anybody have an idea? A hair cell. That's a really wild guess. What side of the bed did you wake up? How can a hair cell give you the sense of hearing? Okay. Because, you're right actually, because, oh yeah, it's got those stereocilia that bend back and forth that send electrical information to the brain. So, the receptor cell for hearing is a hair cell. What about for linear acceleration? What's the receptor cell? You're kidding me. No, you're not kidding me. You're right. It's a hair cell. And what about for angular acceleration? It's a hair cell. Right? The same kind of receptor cell, just it has been embedded in a little bit different kind of material, different kind of organ, goes to a different part of your brain, and it gives you three radically different kinds of senses. Okay? So that, I find that pretty amazing. All right? So make sure that you understand this organization and how the ear is laid out, okay? And also you should probably know something about the internal structure of the cochlea, like the different chambers, the scala vestibuli, scala tympani, the oval window, round window, tympanic membrane, right? The maculae inside the vestibule and the crista ampullarii that are inside the semicircular canals, okay? All right, so that's pretty good for hearing. And so this is why, when people ask me, why did they change the name of the nerve, all right, from auditory nerve to vestibulocochlear nerve? Because this nerve right here, right, is not just the auditory nerve, it doesn't come just from the cochlea, right, but it also comes from the crista ampullaris and the utricle and saccule, which are senses of equilibrium, so we have to call this the vestibulocochlear nerve, right? So that's an important cranial nerve. And hopefully you could tell me which number that is. Okay? You might have to work through your mnemonic. You don't have to know it right off the top of your head, but you should be able to figure it out within, you know, a couple minutes. Right? How would you know the number of the vestibular cochlear nerve? What would you use on a test?
On Old Olympus Towering Top.
Oh, that's a good one. That's one of my favorite ones. On Old Olympus's Towering Top, a Finnan German viewed a hop. Right? So vestibular cochlear is really what? A in that particular little saying. Because it used to be just called the auditory nerve. All right. So that's everything in your notes. All right, and so that's the last bit. Oh, no, heart is on your test, too, coming up. So good thing we can do a little introduction to the heart today to get you started on that. All right, so material on the test can come from stuff that we talk about in lecture. It can come from the exam figures, right? It can come from questions at the end of the book. Where else can exam questions come from? Probably like the pre-lecture study material. Those questions are really good. So all of those things you should have down pat. As a matter of fact, you should have those things answered before lecture. That will make lecture even more fun, okay, and meaningful for you if you do the pre-lecture reading assignment ahead of time. Because they're really simple questions. And if you're floundering with the pre-lecture reading questions the night before the test, it's like too late. You have no hope, right? So do it before lecture, not before the test, is what I'm trying to say for that. All right, so let's change topics some and move on to the heart. And where the heck is the heart at? Is that 18? 18, chapter 18, nice, so here's 18, and that's a pretty nice picture of the heart. Okay, well you see some big cavities inside that. Can I erase the board right here right now? Okay. So I'll erase this. Hopefully you've copied all that down. But you can reconstruct this table with the help of your textbook, no problem. So the job of the heart is to pump blood. So it's a muscular pump. All right, and what is muscle specialized to do? To contract. So the heart pumps blood by contracting the muscle. Right, and so there are chambers inside the heart with fill up with blood, and then when the heart contracts, that blood is squished out and it flows through your vascular system as a result. So those chambers of the heart have a couple different names. How many chambers does the heart have? Four different chambers, right? So if you're going to think of the heart, a nice way to think of the heart is that it kind of looks like a triangle, okay? And this is always a good place to start, especially on the practicum, because when you walk up to a heart, you might not really appreciate everything that's right there in front of you, and you might get misoriented. All right, so this is where you should always start. The tip of a triangle or a pyramid, what do we call the tip of a pyramid? This is the apex. All right, so here is apex. And then what is a pyramid sitting on, or the other end of the triangle is the base. Here's the base, all right, of the heart. So let's just not talk about pyramids or triangles, but this pointy end is the apex, but it is what? Pointing inferiorly in our body, and the base is superior. Your heart is about as big as your fist, if you're kind of interested how big your heart is. A lot smaller than the hearts that we've been looking at in lab, of course. And your heart, it's kind of interesting because a lot of times in this class when we've looked at anatomy, for instance, if we've got a sartorius on our right leg, guess what we have on our left leg? We got a sartorius, right? And if we got a number one digit on our right hand, what do we got on our left hand? a number one digit. So we have a lot of bilateral symmetry that we've looked at so far. And here we get away from that bilateral symmetry just a little bit. Okay, and that's because if you look at the heart, is it right smack in the middle of your body, or is it more on one side than the other? It's more on the left side, right? So it's not purely, we lose some of that bilateral symmetry a little bit. All right, something else that's interesting about the heart is that it's just not offset to the left side of your body. It gets to the left side of your body because it's angulated. So as you move from base to apex, there's a tilt associated with the heart. So the heart actually is tilted a little bit. But when I start talking about the heart, I just draw it straight up and down. All right, but you should really appreciate that. As you go from base to apex, the heart tilts to the left. It's kind of like that. All right, that's one angulation, but the heart is doubly angulated inside your chest. As you go from base to apex, it doesn't just move to the left, it does something else too. And it also moves anteriorly like that. So there are two angles associated with the heart, okay? As you go from base to apex, it's tilted to the left, but it's also tilted anteriorly like this. So the most superficial part of the heart is which part? The apex or the base? The apex, that's right. And every time your heart beats, it's a kind of a violent reaction. That apex of the heart just pounds up against your thoracic wall, and you can feel that pounding, and that's called the point of maximal impulse. We call that the PMI. So a lot of times, if you're not really sure where somebody's heart is, maybe you're putting on ECG electrodes, or maybe you got to stab them in the heart to suck some fluid out from a pericardial cavity or something, you always check for that point of maximal impulse and find out exactly where their heart is. That's a pretty easy way to do that. Okay? So that's kind of about something about the size, the shape, location of the heart. All right? Now, to really appreciate the heart has two sides. Guess what the two sides are? You got a right and a left. All right? And so when you see a heart, it's easy to see apex, easy to see base, but how are you going to know the right side from the left side without looking inside the heart? If you look inside the heart, it's really easy, but there is a marking on the surface that separates the right from the left, and it's a really nice thing to observe, easy to see on a real heart. If I had a real heart, the people in the back row could even tell me. And because there is a depression, what do we call a depression in anatomy? That's a sulcus. Right, so here is a depression, and as you go from the base to the apex, it doesn't go straight down, but it's on an angle. And this separates the couple main chambers out. There's a depression that's filled with pericardial fat. That pericardial fat is yellow or white, and the muscle tissue itself is dark brown. So there's really good contrast between this sulcus and the myocardial tissue. This sulcus is called the anterior longitudinal sulcus. Sometimes it goes by another name. Sometimes people call it the interventricular sulcus. So it's separating the ventricles of the heart. But this is probably even a better description, because if you see this is the anterior longitudinal sulcus, what side of the heart is that? Is that anterior or posterior? It's got to be the anterior side. So if you know base, apex, anterior side, what side is this over here? This would be like looking at my heart. Well, I'm right-handed. What side is this over here? Right, and this is left. So here is the left side of the heart, and here is the right side of the heart. So in lab, during a practicum, when you see a heart, the three things that should pop into your mind immediately to get oriented are what? Apex, base, anterior longitudinal sulcus, and then everything else just kind of falls into place, right, as long as you don't freak out. If you're freaking out, where do you start? Is that hard?
No.
Take a deep sigh of relief. What's number two? Base. Is that hard? No. You're almost home free. And then what's the last thing? Anterior longitudinal sulcus, and then things should start coming to you. Okay. All right, so what about the chambers of the heart? Did I make that sound too simple? You know what? That's really about as hard as it is. Okay? So just start with those first three things. All right, so you said that there are four chambers on the heart, right? So let's break it up into four chambers. This we said was left, and this is right. These bottom chambers down here are what we call ventricles. And these chambers near the base are called atria. All right, so now we can label the chambers, right? Or correcto? This is right atrium. That's the RA. This is the RB. This is the LA. And this is the LV. Just like that. You can practice saying the words out. Okay. A lot of times people don't spend time saying the words. They just say LV, RB. Okay. So how many chambers does the heart have?
Four.
Two atria, two ventricles. Okay. That's pretty good. So I'm going to just erase these things right here. All right. So the job of the heart is to pump blood, which is a fluid. A gas is a fluid. Liquid is a fluid. And gas or liquids will flow from one place to another based on what kind of parameter? Anybody know the physical parameter that will move a fluid from one place to another? Like if you look at a weather map, air is going to move from one part of the country to another based on by pressure gradients. And a fluid will always move according to what law? Low pressure to high, high pressure to low, equal pressure to equal pressure, or what? High pressure to low pressure. Fluid will flow. Okay? And so that's the job of these ventricles right here, is to squeeze down. Think of squeezing down on a balloon. What happens to the pressure inside that balloon when you squeeze down on it? Does it go up or down or stay the same? It goes up, right? So the heart, when it contracts, it produces pressure that squirts blood into various vessels then that flows through your circulatory system. So that's the job of the heart. And blood should flow through the heart in one direction. Okay? It shouldn't go backwards. Think of if you're down here with me, but you needed to go up to the bathroom and you need to walk up the stairs. Say if you're walking up the stairs, you took two steps up and then two steps back, and then two steps up and then two steps back, what would happen? Well, you'd be miserable all day long, right? And eventually you'd probably die. Same thing for the heart, okay? If the heart is pumping blood, but it doesn't go in one direction, that's going to kill the heart. So there are things inside the heart that make sure that blood flows in only one direction. What do you call those things? Those are valves. All right, so my question was earlier, how many chambers does the heart have?
Four,
right? And you got to know where they are, what their name is. How many valves does the heart have?
Four
valves as well, so four and four. You got to know where these valves are. Okay, so there, the left atrium pumps blood into the left ventricle. So there's got to be a hole right here. Blood should flow in this direction only. That's what we call antrograde or forward. But when the ventricle contracts, it's going to try to force blood up back into the left atrium. And like we said, that's going to kill the heart and, of course, kill you. What prevents retrograde flow or backward flow of blood? There is a valve right here. All right, so here's a valve. And generally, what do we call this valve? What's the general name of this valve? And there's going to be one on the right side of the heart as well. It's going to be one here that allows blood to flow in this direction only. This is an atrioventricular valve. Atrioventricular valve. All right, so the atrioventricular valves have different number of leaflets or cusps, these little flaps that open and close. The one on the right side of the heart has got three. And I can't draw three really well, so I'll put like three right here. So the name of this valve, we said for sure was atrioventricular, but it's got a particular name. This is what we call the tricuspid AV valve. And AV stands for atrioventricular valve. This one over here has only got two flaps. So that's, do we call that a tricuspid if it only has two? That's called the bicuspid, right? So bicuspid AV valve. And it's got another name because way back when people saw this structure with two flaps on it like this, it reminded who was ever dissecting the heart of some really fancy hats that people wear sometimes. It has these two flaps to it, and you put it on your head like this. Okay, I walk around. Some of them are white. Some are like really red. And that's called a mitre. Who would wear those fancy hats? You see who am I talking about? I'm talking about like the Pope, right? And bishops and cardinals in the Holy Roman Catholic Church would wear these things when they're celebrating certain events. Okay, and that's called a mitre. So sometimes this is called the mitral valve. All right, so bicuspid and mitral are the same. They're used interchangeably, even in the same sentence. So you got to know that it's the same valve. All right, so on the right side, what's the atrial ventricular valve? The tricuspid. And on the left side, it's the bicuspid. How are you going to memorize that if you're freaking out on a test?
Try before you buy.
Try before you buy, right? So tricuspid and then bicuspid on the other side, right? So you should be able to get that down. All right, so how many valves have we talked about so far?
Two.
How many more do we got?
Two.
We got two more to talk about. All right. Well, let's talk about some vessels first before we talk about the last two valves. All right, so and they don't belong on the heart, but I'm going to draw them here. All right, I'm just going to draw some blood vessels like this, and I'm going to draw an arrow saying that this blood vessel is taking blood away from the heart. What kind of vessel takes blood away from the heart? By definition, always, always, always. Okay, don't forget, you got arteries, you got capillaries and veins. A vessel that takes blood away from the heart is always going to be an artery, no matter what kind of blood it's pumping. All right, so here is an artery, right? Artery. What is this thing here? Blood is leaving over here. Is that a vein or an artery? That's an artery. All right, here's another artery. This one from the left side of the heart is what we call the aorta. Sometimes you might want to say aortic artery, but when you say aorta, everybody knows you're talking about an artery. This one over here is going to take blood to, tell me what this is. Yeah, and there's a little space right here for somebody's heart. All right, so what do you call a specialty that just studies lungs all the time? Like if you have lung problems, the kind of physician you would like to see is a pulmonologist, right? So this is what we call the pulmonary circulation going to the lungs. So hence this artery right here is called the pulmonary artery. All right, so this should give you a glimpse. How many circulations are there in the body? There is the systemic circulation that is fed by the aorta, and then there is the pulmonary circulation that's fed by the pulmonary artery. Okay. We're going to get back to these valves in just a little bit, but here is a blood vessel that's bringing blood back to the heart, and there's one here bringing blood back to the heart. What do we call blood vessels that bring blood back to the heart? These are veins. All right, so here's a vein, and in particular, this is blood coming back from the lung, so this is the pulmonary vein, and there's actually four of them. All right, so I'll just kind of mislabel it. I'll call that a pulmonary vein. And this one here is bringing blood back from the systemic circulation. This is what we call the great cavernous vein, vena cava. All right, and there's two. There's a superior one and an inferior one. All right, so veins do what? Bring blood back to the heart. Arteries take blood away all the time. All right, well, the ventricles, remember, contract and relax. Contract, develop a lot of pressure, and it squirts blood into the aorta. And then what does the ventricle do? It relaxes, and what happens to the pressure in the ventricle when it relaxes? It decreases. It almost goes to zero. So if you have high pressure blood in the aorta and the pressure in the left ventricle goes to zero, which way is blood going to flow? From the aorta back into the ventricle. And if that happens to you, what's going to happen? Well, your head is going to hit the table and then it's going to hit the chair and then it's going to bounce off the floor, right? And you won't live very long, like 3 minutes. So blood should only flow in one direction. What's preventing the retrograde flow of blood from the aorta back into the left ventricle? There is a valve. So valves prevent retrograde flow, right? So here it is right here. And in particular, somebody told me already the specific name of this valve. Okay? And there's going to be one over here and over here. These are what we call semilunar valves. The one at the root of the aorta is the aortic semilunar valve. I'll abbreviate it. And this one over here is what? The pulmonary. What? Semilunar valve right here. So those are the four valves that you have. Two atrioventricular, two semilunar. All these blood vessels, though, remember, come off the base of the heart, not down over here, but the diagram was just too confusing to draw otherwise. All right, one last thing. Between this artery, okay, which is going to come back to the vena cava to bring blood to the right atrium, we got some things right here. This is the third kind of blood vessel. And I drew it as a network. This is a microscopic network of blood vessels. Arteries take blood to this object, and from this object, veins bring it back to the heart. What's the name of this object right here?
Capillary.
That's a capillary bed. All right, capillary. Capillary bed. More important, I want to know what the function of that capillary bed is. Arteries take blood away from the heart. That's their function. Veins bring it back to the heart. What's the function of a capillary bed? In just one word, you should know what that is. Starts with an E. That's where exchange takes place. This is the only place in the vascular system where material that's in the blood can actually leave. Like, give me an example. Maybe oxygen leaving the blood to supply muscle tissue, where oxygen can leave, or maybe other waste products can enter from the systemic circulation. Anybody know a name of a byproduct of life that your body gets rid of? Like CO2. So gas exchange can only take place in a capillary, not an artery or a vein. And when we get to the next chapter, we'll see why that is. All right, but this is just kind of a quick introduction to cardiovascular system. All right, so the sign-in sheet is around someplace. I got it right here. And so I think we're still on track to having the test on November 18th. That's still a week from today. Huh? Pulmonary artery? Here's pulmonary vein coming out. Nope. That's a pulmonary artery. I'll have to convince you of that. The pulmonary veins take blood from the lungs back to the heart. That's the definition of a vein. So we'll work on that. Back to the heart is a pulmonary vein. So from here to here is a pulmonary vein. The pulmonary vein is oxygenated. Yeah, no, you're beginning to crystallize your understanding. That's a really important understanding.